Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California and in parallel from the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And a pleasant good afternoon and welcome to the Water Zone Show. I'm Rob Starr along with my acclaimed and unbelievable host, Mr. Chris Davies. Chris, how are you?
Doing great, Rob. Thanks for that. So unbelievable. Do I tell a lot of fibs?
No. Unbelievable. That's a good thought, though. Didn't mean it that way. Unbelievable person, because you bring a lot of good stuff to the show, as does our next call-in guest, which we appreciate all the time. But I understand you're down by the beach.
Yeah. Spending some time with the family here, beachside. So the sun is about to set here on the left coast, right, in California. So I'm sitting, actually, with my phone plugged in my truck, watching the sunset over the Pacific Ocean. It's beautiful.
Lucky guy. I wish I was doing it. And somebody, some little birdie told me you went fishing today and did really good.
Yeah, we did. Took the kayaks out, a mile and a quarter offshore, found some kelp patties tied up, and did a little fishing. We did really well. Did indeed.
You're a brave guy going out in a little kayak, mile and a half. I don't know if I'd even picture that. But anyway, let's bring on our most famous person that we deal with all the time, and she's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, which is the best source of California water news, Miss Chris Austin. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, guys. How you doing tonight?
We'd be fine. Blended. Sounds like Chris is doing, I guess Chris Davies doing the best.
He's got I know, man. What I wouldn't give to be there. I must be amazing.
Yeah. Well, there was no, just a quick question to Mr. Davies. Chris, there wasn't any restrictions on being there with the COVID stuff?
No. So what they've got is, there's automatic spacing, right, with the campsite spread out so far the way they are. But you are limited to 8 people per campsite, and they have to be either your family or people you live with.
Oh, okay. So if I came down, I couldn't say I'm your brother. I don't look like so. Probably wouldn't work.
They wouldn't care. There's not 8 of us here, so come on down, buddy. I'll tag in the afterwards. I'll give you the campsite number.
I'd love to. A little further drive that I want to do today. So, anyway, Chris, I was reading your wonderful publication this morning, as I do every morning, and you had some pretty interesting topics. I thought maybe we can kind of kick those around and see what's what. You see, Trump has creates a new water sub cabinet. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Yes, President Trump announced, he wrote another executive order to create this water sub-cabinet, which is, kind of his way of dealing with a lot of water issues, not just here in the western U.S., but also around, the United States, and including the Florida Everglades and the Great Lakes, which, just as an aside, it's interesting that he has created this office, because he actually tried to, reduce funding drastically for the Florida Everglades and the Great Lakes. But, hey, now he's on board, so cool. And this also affects the western U.S. because he has been trying to do what he can do as the President of the United States to increase water to farmers, water deliveries to farmers. And it's a campaign promise he made in 2016, and he has issued a number of executive orders in order to trying to make this happen. And so there are critics that are saying, that he's doing this because it's just weeks before an election and he's trying to bolster the support that he has. We'll see what happens when it all plays out. There's so many executive orders. There's so many lawsuits going on. We'll have to see how it all plays out. And, you know, an executive order doesn't necessarily have the force of law, so we'll see, you know, we'll see what it really means in the long run. He's talking about reducing unnecessary duplication in government and consolidating existing water-related task force and stuff. I'm not sure how much of that can happen because from what I've seen, I haven't seen on the federal level what I would consider to be a lot of duplicative work groups, but I am not completely in touch with the federal level, so we'll see what it all means.
I look at it this way. It doesn't matter which party or which person's in office. They get elected to serve a four-year term, and I don't expect any one of them, and again, whatever party they're with, to stop working just because it's getting near their term. I mean, it's like people who are going to retire, and then the last couple of weeks they don't want to do anything at work. You know, you get a lot of that. Or I knew some people who knew they were going to retire in 6 months did do a lot of work in 6 months. But you know, at least somebody's trying, and I hope whoever is the next president will just keep on working until the day that they're not supposed to work anymore. So I think that's a good idea. So I saw another story about, which is interesting, lawns that are providing a surprising contribution to LA's basin carbon emissions.
It's interesting. The National Oceanic Administration, NOAA, I can't get all the names right, but this is the government agency, and they have been studying what can be done to reduce carbon emissions, and they've been actually taking measurements in different places to kind of see what happens. And through this research, they have a way to determine what carbon dioxide is coming from fossil fuel emissions, i.e., you know, car tailpipes, burning of gasoline and natural gas. They can separate that from the carbon dioxide that is naturally emitted from plants. And they actually found that a surprising amount of carbon emissions coming out of Los Angeles, up to a third of them, are actually coming from lawns and the vegetation in the basin and not the tailpipe, one third. So that's pretty substantial.
That's positive.
And it's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a positive thing, yeah?
Well, I don't know if it's positive. It's informative to you if you want to create policies that are going to reduce carbon in the atmosphere. And this is why they're conducting this research, because with a lot of focus on how to reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, people are proposing a lot of different things. And, you know, carbon is kind of invisible. You can't see it. You can't see it go into the ground. So how do you know that you're really going to do something? So they have to kind of figure out how it would work to, you know, do a large-scale carbon emissions. And it's informative to understand that, that fossil fuels is only two-thirds of the story. You can control fossil fuel emissions from cars and trucks and whatever, theoretically. Much harder to control it from the vegetation. And so perhaps it points to things not being as effective as people might hope they might be, I guess. Mm-hmm. Sort of like, you know, we had the pandemic and we had this almost for several weeks, this complete or almost complete shutdown, and people weren't driving anywhere. And the sad part was that it really showed, you know, that the reduction in carbon emissions during that time was not huge, like maybe 13%, which kind of, it's not good news if you're a fan of trying to reduce carbon emissions. because the whole world shut down pretty much as it could, and yet there was only a slight reduction in, you know, carbon dioxide emissions. So it's not necessarily good news, I guess.
I thought, you know, I thought it was when you said lawns and trees and stuff, I thought you meant it was absorbing more carbon.
Oh, no, it's emitting.
Trees absorb it, give out oxygen. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's part of the natural part of life, you know, for plants, is they have, you know, they have their own emissions. So do pine trees, you know. So the hope is that, you know, like people want to add a lot of trees, and the hope is that the trees will absorb more carbon than they emit, but there is a back and forth with that carbon dioxide emission. You know, it's plants take it in that they also emit it. So it's a challenge.
I remember a couple of years ago, and it was a big deal about it, and then it seemed to be relaxed, and I don't know what happened, where they were trying to ban charcoal for barbecues and said that was a bad thing to do, and yet you see on television all these barbecue manufacturers who are making stuff that you need to burn stuff, literally. And I don't know whatever happened. Has anybody heard why that kind of stopped? And because they said it was all bad to burn all this stuff, and now they're continuing doing it.
I'm going to make a guess that had probably more to do with air quality emissions than trying to sequester carbon or address climate change. But I can't say that for sure. I'm just going to guess that off the top of my head, because there was a big push to clean up the air in Southern California. And you can remember, if you have been here for a couple decades, you can remember how bad it used to be, really bad. And they've done amazing things for cleaning it up, but they really, you know, got down to even considering the postal vehicles that were, you know, because when a postman drives up to the mailbox and that engine keeps running, they're emitting. And so you notice now, like, they seem to be, they're electric cars. They're, you know, school buses are no longer diesel burning. They're all clean burning. They really went and attacked a lot of these different sources for emissions to clean up the air. And when you, including additives in the gas, that does tend to make California gas more expensive. But if you lived in Southern California 20 years ago versus living in Southern California today, wildfires, you know, you got to exclude those. The air is so much better. And it's because they attacked all these different sources of it, not just one, but many different things.
I agree with you. I mean, many years ago when I was in private school in the San Fernando Valley, they used to cancel a lot of our outdoor sports because of the smog and all the other things. So, yeah, I attest to that. And, yeah, I assume it's better today. But we got a wonderful climate scientist coming on after you. So we can save up some good questions for that person. It's surprising. You know, when I read that thing about how it's contributing to the carbon emissions, I was kind of surprised at that. But anyways, again, that's what this show's for. It's interesting to know why all that thing is happening. Another topic that the Department of Water Resources is, I heard, teaming up with state and fed groups to protect endangered species in the state water project waters. You can fill us in a little about what that's happening, and then any other exciting items that we all should know about.
Well, the State Water Project kind of blazed its own trail back, I don't know, 6 months, a year ago, when they decided they were going to do their own permitting for the State Water Project, independent of the federal permit for the Central Valley Project. And in years prior, they've always, the state had always done what is called a consistency determination, where they say there's a determination made that compliance with the federal regulations will constitute compliance with the state regulations, and everything is good. But with this sort of split going on between the federal government operations and the state operations, you know, the state sort of decided to take its own path. And so what this story was really about was the steps that they are taking to do this. You know, what's interesting is they actually mandate, or they actually say that this new permit says that they have to reduce water exports out of the Delta. And it's my understanding that the federal permit is actually trying to push the other way. They're trying to get more water out of the Delta. So it's going to be interesting to see how this works. But, you know, they're saying they are committed to working with people and working with the, you know, the water contractors on for the state water project, you know, to work all these issues out. It's going to remain to be seen how it all works out, because there is some significant tension, I think, between the federal guidelines for water exports and the state guidelines for water exports. And sort of hanging in the balance are, you know, the endangered species. And, you know, I'm just going to toss in, there is so much focus on Delta smelt, which are admittedly a small fish with no commercial value.
Right.
There's really virtually no emphasis on the fact that the same factors contributing to the Delta smelt decline have also contributed to the decline of salmon, of California salmon, you know, which is something that, you know, that has a commercial value. You know, I'm a little puzzled, or maybe I'm not, why the focus is on the Delta smelt, because there's a huge salmon industry, and, you know, I think California people like eating California salmon, and they're just sort of left out of the picture. And because I have a minute here, I just want to throw this out, because not everybody realizes this. Salmon are not just fish in the ocean. The reason why the state of California is concerned about salmon is because they have an amazing life cycle. Salmon are born in the rivers and streams in California, in the Central Valley, way up by Shasta and all the way in by, you know, up Fresno. I mean, they're way up in the rivers, and they are born in the rivers, and when they hatch from their eggs, they hang around for a while, and then they go out to the ocean. They migrate out through the Delta. They live out in the ocean for 2 to 3 years, and then they come back through the Delta, and they go back to the same place in the river where they were born, sometimes the same, what they call riffle. I mean, it is an amazing story of nature that they are able to do this. So the same river conditions, the same Delta conditions that impact the Delta smelt also impact the salmon. And we have 4 runs of salmon, which means that almost, you know, at all times of the year, we have salmon migrating up to spawn and to create the next generation of salmon. And we have baby salmon swimming out to the ocean to become adult salmon. It is an amazing story. Salmon are, they're incredible. They're awesome.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of Chris Davies' favorite stories on fishing. He loves fish. Right, Chris?
I do indeed.
And he's a superb cook as well.
Thank you.
I've tasted his wares. They're delicious.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's true. Many times. Except for the time I brought him frozen shrimp one time by mistake. It's a long story. I went to Chris's house for dinner one night, and I said, I bring your hors d'oeuvres. I went in the store and got some shrimp, and they handed it to me. I didn't realize that when they packed it, it was set up in an hors d'oeuvres plate, and everything else got to the place, and it was frozen.
Frozen solid.
Yeah. So he enjoyed it the day after. But anyway, but no, it's two stories with the salmon, so didn't mean to divulge this on that. Anyway, but one of the last things I want to talk about, I do a lot of work with Coachella Valley Water District out in Indio, and know their Jim Barrett, who's their general manager. But I saw a thing where a federal report shows increasing groundwater levels in the Coachella Valley. So I guess they're doing a great job in managing that.
Oh, you know, really, we did talk about the Coachella Valley a few weeks ago. Yeah, I mean, they are in touch with their groundwater basin, and they have really been managing it well. And, you know, hats off to them. Their groundwater levels are rising. But, you know, the Coachella Valley was not declared one of the critically overdrafted basins. So, I mean, there's a lot of things going on out there with water in that area. There's a lot of golf courses.
They grow a lot of dates.
Yeah, they grow dates. And also now, apparently, they're becoming the place for these new surf parks, where they have perfected how to create waves in a water park environment so people can go surfing. So apparently they've got a number of those opening up as well. And it's really easy to look at them and say, well, that's all wasteful use of water. But they do control their water use very carefully. They have agriculture out there that depends on some imports from the All-American Canal, which is from the Colorado River, and they do recharge into the groundwater basins, but they really control their tailwater off the farm. I do believe that they're not allowed to have any tailwater, which means that all water that is delivered to that farm must be used on that farm, and there can't be little bits dribbling out, you know, off into the Salton Sea, which is vast difference from the Imperial Valley, who's had, you know, I'm not sure how it is now, because it's my understanding they've been forced to not allow so much water to flow off into the Salton Sea, but that was never the case in the Coachella Valley. So, I mean, they hats off to them. They might have a lot of water uses that, you know, some people may not agree with, but they are managing their water, and they're being smart about it. So, you know,
absolutely. Good for them. I give them kudos. I worked a lot of years with those guys on projects with us, our company, and very happy for that. So, Chris, we're creeping up to our halftime commercial break, and I just want to let our listeners know, if you want to be the know-of-all of all water in California, go to mavensnotebook.com. It's California's independent, most trusted source for water news and information. And just so you know, it's mainly supported by sponsorships and donations from readers like you. Please check it out. It's a great source for water. I get it delivered on my email every single morning. And it keeps me up to date, because I can't be everywhere and anywhere, but Chris does. That's amazing to me. So, again, mavensnotebook.com, and look it up and be a sponsor. So, Chris, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on every single week, and both Chris Davey and I enjoy the little chats we have with every week.
Absolutely. Hey, stay safe, guys.
Stay safe, everyone. All right, we're gonna take a little commercial break, and then we'll be back with our featured guest. Very interesting, a fun scientist. So, we'll catch you in a few.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Okay, welcome back to the second half of Water Zone. We appreciate all your assistance. We want to apologize for that slight interruption there or lack of... anything happening. Just so everybody knows, we're avoiding on purpose to result to the radio station studio, the broadcasting studio of NBC out here in Southern California because of the COVID-19 situation. And both Chris and I and Chris Austin are all in different locations. And it's hard when we're not sitting next to each other as we usually do and looking at each other. And like, I can see crossed in the glass to see the engineer and all that. It makes it tough. So sometimes we step on people when we're trying to interrupt, or we're not trying to interrupt, but we don't know that they're finished. So again, we sincerely apologize for that. But right now, hopefully we have our next guest on the show. And this person is an amazing person, an amazing background. And her name is Dr. Mirav Ben-David. And she's out of Utah. So good afternoon, Dr. Ben-David.
Hey, good evening. I'm from Wyoming, and here it's already evening. Good talking to you guys.
Great. Welcome well, I should show. Probably say to you, I should say to you, shalom, and welcome to the show. And just a couple things before we start. I know, understand you're running for office out in your territory. Maybe you wanted to tell us a little about that so our listeners and your listeners can hear about it.
Sure, absolutely. I am a professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Wyoming and a climate scientist. I study the effects of climate change on polar bears in the Arctic Ocean, including other species such as river otters in Alaska and other places. But this election cycle, I realized that because of the challenges we're facing in terms of climate change and other things that have like COVID-19 that showed up unexpectedly, that I need to do more. And so I am running for the U.S. Senate to represent the wonderful state of Wyoming.
Ah, excellent. Well, that's good to hear. And so we can dive into some of the questions here, and you're the expert, and we want to hear from you. Up to a certain percentage of people on Earth may see an increased climate change-induced water stress by limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. How is it important to the Earth's water supply that we get climate change under control?
It's very important. It's critical. We have fresh drinking water is actually one of the most limiting resources on Earth. You know, when you look at Earth from space, you see a watery world, but in reality, very little of it is drinking water quality. A lot of it is salt water and takes a lot of energy to desalinate. So, yeah, drinking water, fresh water, clean fresh water is a very important resource. And as we see with climate change, the distribution of rainfall and snowfall is changing, such that areas like Wyoming, where we are here now, can experience severe droughts. In fact, we are expecting a very significant increase, up to 40% increase in the frequency of droughts. And that leaves us with very little water to share downriver with you guys. The Colorado River headwaters are here in Wyoming. And so when we don't have the snowfall, we don't have the snowpack, and then we have early spring freshet that all our snow melts quickly and flows down into our reservoirs, then you guys don't have the water that you need.
Right.
Right. Well, Dr. Ben David, welcome to the show. This is Chris, the other co-host. So continuing on with that kind of train of thought, right, some of the data you provided say between 184 million and 270 million fewer people are projected to be exposed to an increase in water scarcity by the time 2050 runs comes around. And that's continuing with the 1.5 degrees Celsius change. So that's a lot of people that are going to be needing water. Is there really enough water to go around?
Well, it will depend on how it basically rainfall and snowfall will change in distribution. When we have, we're going to see more flooding, more severe rainstorms. Just what happened in France this summer, where they had incredible, it was an incredible amount of rain that fell in just a few hours and flooded southern France. We are going to see extreme events like this becoming more frequent, and it's going to disrupt our regular water supply globally. Some areas will see a lot more, and a lot more of it will flow uncontrollably to the ocean, and other places will see a lot less. So, you know, it will affect the way we humans are distributed on the planet, because this is the one resource that we can do without. And so I and many other people are expecting that we'll see more human migration from areas that will become drier to areas that may become, wetter. So, yeah, what we are looking at right now is not what the future will be like.
Yeah. Well, a couple years back, we had the chairman of IDE Technologies. You probably are familiar with them out of Israel. They're the largest desalination manufacturers to put plants together for the world. And yes, it's been expensive, but I think the technology, just like anything else, over time, people will find new ways, new innovations to help reduce the cost of that. And you know, you're planning, as you said, to run for the U.S. Senate, which is great. And just a silly question, but if you win, you'll be the first woman scientist ever elected to the Senate, which I'd be very proud to see that. But can you change the minds in D.C., what they call the D.C. swamp? That's not going to be an easy challenge, is it?
It's funny that you're using the term swamp when we're talking about water, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm an outsider. Maybe I shouldn't say outsider. I'm not an outsider, but I'm definitely coming with a new perspective. And I would, I don't want to brag or anything, but given my training, I'm going to bring in a totally different approach to how we do things. We scientists, we are trained to look forward. We're identifying problems. We then design research to find out the most limiting factors, set up the processes that lead to the problem. And then using data and facts, we come up with alternative solutions that then we can implement. And
right.
When you look at Washington, what you see right now is most of our lawmakers are actually lawyers, and they're trained mm-hmm. to think, they're trained to rely on precedent rather than on forward-looking. And I think that is something that will be a new perspective that will allow me to introduce new ideas into Washington. And I believe that, that will be extremely valuable because, really, the challenges, as you've been discussing on your show, the challenges that we're going to face in the future will require really forward-thinking and anticipating, A, the problems that we're going to face, and they're not trivial and they're not linear, so you can't think of what is happening today and say this will be the future. No, you have to use all the tools we have to predict and what the world future will look like, and it's sometimes very difficult to do, but that's what we are trained to do as scientists. And then on the other hand, to bring in the technological innovations. For example, what you mentioned about Israel, where I'm originally from, you know, Israel invested tremendously in desalination. In fact, 90% or more of Israel's fresh water right now comes from desalination. And so, you know, can we do that globally? What would be the implications of doing this globally? Are there other ways we can use water and create drinking water? And that's only, you know, drinking water is the most significant issue, but it's not the only one. And so, you know, how are things interacting with each other? How are we going, if we do one thing, is it going to have an effect on another ecosystem that we have never imagined? And, you know, so that will require definitely scientific thinking rather than, you know, I don't want to say the swamp, but yes, the swamp.
No, but I agree with you. You know, the implication of water and the need for it. I know in Israel, talking to some of the people that we've worked with, they're growing crops that can not be affected as much with salinity and things of that sort. And, you know, I have two things as a scientist, or I call that because I'm an engineer, but, you know, I have two rules of thumb. One is, in God we trust, all others bring data. I got to see data to prove it. And then you can't walk on water unless you get out of the boat. And I think we need more innovation to happen. And I truly believe, I see it all the time. We've got people on the show from the Global Water Works Association and other things where people are really gathering technology and innovation and partnering more private and public and creating new situations. You know, what I see funny here in the United States, and I'll let Chris go back to the questions, but, you know, we have pipelines for oil and things of that sort. But when it snows back east, why can't we have tunnels to bring water from the melted snow from the back east or heavy rains or storms or even from Louisiana where it floods all the time and ship it to where it needs to be? I mean, those are things that we got to figure out how to do. And maybe that's too drastic a choice to do, but we got to think of things how to make that happen and have more places for water storage. So, Chris, I'll let you go ahead and ask more questions.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks. Dr. Ben Davis, we've seen some elements of climate change happening here in California. For instance, there was just a report that came out that was saying that the mean elevation of the snowpack has been going up for several years now, at least a dozen years. So what that means is, you know, we still get the same amount of storms, we still get the same amount of weather that comes into the West Coast, but it's because of the snow level and global warming and the elevation of snow level rising, that water is not stored, as much of it is not stored in the winter snowpack as before. And so we have to design new ways, figure out new ways to capture and collect and transport that water. The question I'm heading for here, though, is that's also affected the California wildfires, as you know, or anybody, unless you've been living in a cave, has learned about the wildfires. I mean, it's just been significant here. How do the California fires, right, I know you know about them, both here and in Wyoming, how do they threaten our water supply?
That's an excellent question. Is that your dog? Sorry. Hello?
I think it's Rob. Go ahead.
I'm just growling. I'm growling for dinner. Sorry, it is my dog. Again, working remote is not the most easiest thing to do. I'll put it on mute. Sorry.
Right. Okay. So, yes, we have actually had one of the largest fires in Wyoming's recent history, burning right outside of Laramie, Wyoming, where I live. And so, yes, wildfires have become the new norm and a very bad norm. And it definitely has a terrible effect on water quality, because we have when we lose the vegetation, we lose a lot of our filtering capacity. And so definitely wildfires have a negative effect on water quality. But as you mentioned, and especially here in Wyoming, it is a big problem, because climate change causes not only less snow in terms of moving the snow up in elevation, but also because we have early melt in the spring. So basically what used to be stored in snowpack for us has, you know, we've lost this storage for the summer. And so we have, spring freshets that are happening earlier, and we have absolutely no water storage for to keep irrigation going through the summer. We do have reservoirs, and there are a lot of them on the Colorado River, but they have their own problems, because they have, you know, we have a lot of evaporation from open storage, water storage, such as reservoirs. And also, the way we do irrigation is quite wasteful in many cases. You would hardly see such, open canals or sprinklers in Israel, given that a lot of the water evaporates and actually doesn't reach the ground. So I think we'll have to do, in addition to coming up with new ways to address water storage issues, also how we do irrigation.
Well, with regards to the California fires and things, what are the conditions that you believe led to the fire? I hear so many different things, and do you believe that humans contribute to what we're seeing now?
Of course. It's true that one of the reasons we have more severe fires compared to what we used to is that we had a lot of vegetation and fuel buildup. We have been engaging in fire suppression for many, many years. So we have a lot of more fuels on the ground. But if you think about the forests in Washington and Oregon that are burning, these are wet forests. They would not have been burning on a regular basis like maybe some of the forests in California. And also think about your fog forests, where you have the redwoods and sequoias. They've been used, they're adapted to fire, but the fires weren't as extreme as they are now. We have, when you have drought, when you have vegetation that is stressed by drought, the vegetation is more prone to burn. And then you have warm temperature and high winds. And that's exactly what led to the big fire here in Wyoming. We had bark beetle kill in the Rocky Mountains in 2010. Bark beetles, so the larvae survive now the winters, because the winters are warmer. They used to be a major die-off every winter. And now the winters are much warmer. The bark beetles survive, and when they have enough trees to infect, then they explode. Basically, we had an epidemic of the native buzz beetles, pine and spruce bark beetles in the Rocky Mountains, and they killed, in some sense, up to 90% of the trees. So you have a lot of dead trees that have fallen to the ground in storms and logs. When you have fire starting in such a situation, when the live vegetation is stressed, then you have mega fires that, well, you know, we didn't have as frequently as we have now.
Well, Dr. Ben David, I think there's a lot of people who think who are out there and they think, well, climate change took a long time to happen. Right? We're seeing it now. We're seeing a lot of the effects from it. It took a long time to happen, so it will take a long time to correct. Do you believe in that as well? I mean, if somebody right now listening to this radio station, listening to this broadcast, what could they do right now to help combat global warming?
So the one thing that I would say is that combating climate change cannot be left to individuals. Yes, all of us should be driving electric cars and have solar panels installed in our homes so that we can recharge our cars from solar energy. A lot of us can, you know, consume food that are raised locally and, you know, maybe eat less meat. But really, to combat climate change, it will take the entire globe. It will take governments, it will take corporations, it will take non-governmental organizations, environmental groups coming together and working on a global plan. It cannot be left to individuals. As your previous guest mentioned, that when we had the COVID-19 lockdown, we reduced carbon emissions, but it was not as much. Us stopping driving vehicles is going to help, but it's not going to be enough. Because during the shutdown, all the power plants were still going full blast to produce electricity that we used at home. All the factories that were manufacturing, all the agriculture was going on. It's not just individual people that can take action. Individual people, I think our responsibility is to make sure that our policymakers, our lawmakers, take the actions needed globally to combat climate change. And, you know, we can actually do that. It sounds ambitious, but we did it in 2015. 200 countries, multiple corporations, cities, mayors, including many from California, all got together in Paris, and we signed the Paris Climate Accord. And we had a plan. Now, I agree that the plan will need to be revised because we are 5 years into what we were supposed to do and we didn't do it. But we know how to work together. We know how to do it globally. And we absolutely have to do it again. And I think that the United States, we were a global leader. And we need to become global leader again. And my message would be that you can't lead the world if you abandon it. So, as a member of Congress, I will work to definitely work to make sure that we're leading the world again.
Now, I totally agree with you on that, but I have a question. So, I had heard the other day on the news channel that the U.S. has significantly improved in environment conditions here, with temperature and all air, water, all of that, where Russia, China, India are still spewing tons of contaminations and having things increase temperature changes. And yet, I think part of that, and I'm not an expert in the Paris Agreement, but I had thought that we paid a significant portion of those dollars. And we saw enhancements here, but we don't see as much from the other large countries like, again, India, Russia, and China. Do you see that as a truism, or am I wrong in what I heard on the news, or the news reported it incorrectly?
I think that the minute that we pulled out or threatened and then pulled out of the trip, we basically, because we are world leaders, we dropped everything. And our actions led to the basically leading all the other countries not to meet their commitments. And that is unfortunate. That is really unfortunate, and we need to change it. And the fastest way that we do it, the better.
Okay. Good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Just real quickie here. I know you had mentioned you did a lot of things about climate and water when you were in Antarctica. That sounds really interesting to me. Can you kind of tell our listeners about that, what you learned?
So I studied the effects of climate change on polar bears in the Arctic Ocean. And I can tell you that being there personally, I have seen how fast the Arctic sea ice is melting, and much faster than projections. And I think that we basically have to engage and immediately take action to combat climate change sooner than later before it is too late.
How long do we have left? I mean, do you believe the evaluation out there that says the velocity of climate change is ramping up very quickly now, right? The curve is steepening, if you will, if it's grasped. Do you see that personally and experientially from your past work?
I can tell you that I got very, very concerned all the way back in 2009, even before other people were raising the alarm, because I have been in the Arctic Ocean personally, and I've seen what is happening with my own eyes and feeling it on my own skin. It's not just the data and the data analysis and the modeling, but also personal observation. And I have had the pleasure of working with many indigenous people in our region, and they had observations that even go longer term than mine, and they are very concerned. We talk to Alaska and Canadian natives, they will tell you that they've never ever experienced things changing so fast. And yeah, it's if we want to have a future for our children, we have to take this seriously.
Well, I saw the dedication there, Dr. Ben David, and certainly hope that as a senator in D.C., that you can go there and change some minds.
I still hope so, and if your listeners are interested in supporting our campaign, they can check us out at bendavid2020.com.
Wow. So any final words that you want to give our listeners about what we should expect in the next, say, 10 years, if we don't straighten up here?
Well, I think we can straighten, and we can do a lot, and I think that when we come together, we get stuff done. So my words of wisdom will be, let's get stuff done.
I love that, that aura of optimism in there, because so many people that we talk to, even people that Rob and I have had on the show, Dr. Ben David, seem to be more, you know, more downtrodden about it, a little more pessimistic than you are, right? So sky is falling and Chicken Little. So it's good to see the optimism. Thank you.
Absolutely. So thank you very much for taking the time to call us, and we do appreciate that. We'll keep in contact with you. So to our listeners, thank you very much. Again, excuse the unorthodox way we're trying to broadcast, but again, when you're not in the studio, it's kind of hard to work our magic, so we appreciate you listening. So everybody have a great time, and the most important thing that Chris and I want you to do is keep your planet blue. Great. Good night, everybody. Talk to you next week.
All right, everybody.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
AP News, I'm Tim McGuire. President Trump and Democrat Joe Biden held separate town halls this evening.